Chapter 9. Social Anxiety and Performance Anxiety. Julie, aged 23. Julie is a 23-year-old university student. She comes to me because she's finding it very difficult to cope at university and to follow the lectures. She is academically ambitious, but her social anxiety prevents her from being present and attending her place of study. She's also inhibited by her anxiety in other situations, but it is at university where the problem is greatest. Julie has a metacognition about a lack of control over her own thought processes, but she also has some very strong positive metacognitions, and she tries to replay the different social scenarios to herself so that she is prepared when she faces them. She cannot remember exactly how long she has used overthinking as a coping strategy, but it is probably more or less always. I ask her how effective this strategy is, and whether it helps her to worry for the 4 hours leading up to a social situation. Are there any consequences for worrying so much beforehand? Yes, there are many, she says, and tells me that in the few hours leading up to a lecture or social get-together she has been invited to, she feels more and more anxious. Either her anxiety inhibits her so much that she's not able to act and show up at all, or she does show up, but with a lot of emotional discomfort and therefore a poorer performance as a result. This means she tries to understand and anticipate her reactions in order to be prepared. But she also tells me that this has great consequences for her. So I wonder why she continues to use this strategy. Julie is not alone in spending many hours thinking in order to prepare herself, and she is far from the only one who responds, as she does, that it is important that she spends a lot of time and energy on this. Does this mean that you have to spend even more time trying to think about being prepared or coming up with a solution, and that 4 hours a day is not enough? But will 10 hours be enough? I ask her. Because if it's a question of time, then we've found the solution to all your problems. So you just have to worry enough about the situation, and it will be resolved while you are prepared for anything. And this is not the case. At some point, Julie, like everyone else, starts to realize that her excessive focus on worrying is not working optimally, and that it has significant emotional and behavioral consequences. And she therefore starts asking me what she should do next. Her realization provides an opening for me to work with, so that I can address the negative metacognitions that are about what Julie has control over and what she does not. Through brief awareness exercises, where Julie has to describe the therapy room and sounds outside, among other things, I show her that she can control her awareness. She can always improve, but the ability is there. Her excessive inward focus needs to be challenged immediately, and therefore it is crucial for her to understand who is in control of her awareness, both the inward and outward aspects. A wall of Cass. I always ask my clients what their goals and wishes are. In Julie's case, her greatest wish is to be more social and to manage herself better and less painfully in social settings. But between her and her desires stands a great wall that makes it impossible for her to be able to act directly on her wishes. The wall consists of her Cass-related thoughts, which, among other things, have contributed to her negative self-image. What if I'm not good enough? What if I don't have anything exciting to say? What if people run away screaming when I try to say something? What if others can see that I'm anxious? Our job now is to minimize her Cass and make the walls smaller so that she spends, for example, only 15 minutes a day on this type of thinking when she normally spends 4 hours each day on it. On a piece of paper, I draw for her how the wall will become smaller and thus how it will also become easier for her to step over the wall and go around it in order to fulfill her desire to engage in social settings on an equal footing with others. I'm not going to start going into her CAS and discussing with her whether it is necessary for her to ruminate, worry, and prepare herself for a social situation, even though right now she feels that it is necessary for her. Initially, we need to minimize the inward focus that is making it difficult for her to act. What others think. I talk to Julie about inward and outward focus, and I ask her what happens when she talks to a person whom she does not know particularly well. Does she have an inward or an outward focus? I have an outward focus, because I think about what I should say the entire time so that I don't annoy the other person, or so that I don't say something that the other person starts laughing at or criticizing me for. I read their signals so that I can adapt myself to them, she says. This is a classic notion. Many people with social anxiety believe that they have an outward focus when they adapt their behavior to what they believe other people are thinking about them. Actually, this is an inward focus, because it is their own thoughts about what others might be thinking. One day, Julie has an appointment with me, and she has taken the subway. She tells me that she felt bad standing among the other people because they were looking at her. But how do you know that they were looking at you? I ask her. Were you looking at them? No, not at all. I use these questions to help Julie to understand the difference between inward and outward focus. She needs to realize that what she believes is outward focus, in reality, is about what she thinks others think of her. In other words, it is a heightened awareness of her own thoughts and other inner psychological phenomena. Safety behavior. Classical cognitive behavioral therapy works by exposing people with social anxiety to what they fear, that is, other people. This might be going out into a crowded street together and asking a random person what time it is, or asking for directions. Gradually, you increase the exposure to the object they fear. In metacognitive therapy, you also expose the client, but the object of anxiety is the person's own thoughts about themselves, their self-image, and not other people. It is these thoughts that Julie needs to be exposed to while, at the same time, I observe her safety behaviors. Safety behaviors are things that we do to cope with situations that we would prefer to avoid, but that we cannot always avoid or escape from. For example, safety behaviors can be getting drunk before a flight, because you are afraid of getting on a plane. When you have social anxiety, a safety behavior might include, for example, having a bottle of water in your hand that you can drink from all the time, or checking your phone every few minutes. It can be anything, but it is always something you do to deal with an uncomfortable situation that you cannot avoid. The problem with safety behavior is that even though it may reduce anxiety in the short term, it reinforces anxiety and avoidance in the long term. It therefore does not offer a lasting solution. This is why I am investigating Julie's safety behavior. You cannot avoid talking to other people, so what do you do to endure the situation? Do you look them in the eye? I ask Julie. No, I look a little to the side, like this, and preferably avoid eye contact. Do you do anything with your hands? Yes, I move them around a bit and put them in my pockets and such, different things. Sometimes I also lift one leg to shake it, she tells me. I also ask her whether she asks questions, interrupts the other person, talks quickly or slowly. In general, I try to find out what she does when she's with others. Then I go through an exercise with her. Also, see Wells, 1997, Chapter 7, Wells, 2009. I tell Julie that in a moment one of my colleagues will come into my office. You just need to have a conversation about 3 minutes long, that's all. During the conversation, I'll ask you to apply all the safety behaviors you have described to me, I say. In this specific case, I have arranged with my colleague that she should ask Julie about her studies. When she begins to ask, Julie exhibits many different types of safety behaviors. And if she forgets to do some of the things that she has told me about, I remind her about them. After 2 or 3 minutes, I send my colleague out again and ask Julie how she felt about the exercise. It was difficult. I thought that it was hard and it was embarrassing because I didn't know her, she says. This is the feeling Julie usually has when she's with others. She clearly expresses that she has been wondering what my colleague thought about her. I then ask Julie some questions that she's not expecting. Do you remember what my colleague looks like? What was the color of her hair? Was she wearing jewelry? And what did her clothes look like? Was she wearing makeup and nail polish? I ask her. Well, I didn't really look at her, she answers. This is a very typical answer. Of course Julie saw her, but she could not give any specific details because she had a predominantly inward focus. Therefore, we go into the second part of the exercise. Now my colleague will come back in again. You'll just continue your conversation, but I want to ask you to do 2 things. First, I'll ask you not to do the things you said that you use as a safety behavior, just for 3 minutes. Second, I'll ask you to pay close attention to her, because afterwards I'm going to ask you a series of questions about her appearance, clothes, jewelry, etc., I tell Julie. After the second meeting with my colleague, Julie tells me that it had not been so bad this time. Julie can also give a pretty full description of her appearance. How did the anxiety feel this time? I ask her. It wasn't nearly as bad as the first time, she says. Can you remember that we talked about the 2 kinds of focus, inward and outward focus? Where was your predominant focus during the first meeting with my colleague? It was probably mostly inward, Julie says. Earlier in the session with me, Julie described similar situations and she felt that she had an outward focus because she was constantly observing what the other person was saying and signaling so that she could adjust her own behavior. But the truth was that she had an excessive inward focus. She can see that now. She can also see that at the second meeting with my colleague, she had a predominantly outward focus. How did you feel at the second meeting? I ask her. I felt much better than at the first, she says. Exactly. That is how it is for everybody. When we look at your performance, what do you think about it? Was it best during the first or the second attempt? The second attempt, Julie says. The lesson here is that with outward focus, you perform better, and that meeting other people does not need to be so bad. This exercise is inspired by Wells, 1997, pages 180 to 182. Exposure to your own thoughts. Julie needs to be exposed to her own negative thoughts about herself. What is it that you don't want others to think of you? What would be the worst thing that they could think? I ask her. I don't want them to think that I'm boring or stupid. And I don't want them to see that I'm anxious or think that I am a mentally ill person. I don't want them to see that I'm insecure, she says. All these thoughts make up Julie's self-image. And it is these thoughts that I must expose her to, because on the one hand, she has a negative image of herself, and on the other, she believes that others see her as she sees herself. I've asked Julie to ask my colleague some questions while I'm filming her, knowing that this is anxiety-provoking for her. The reason why I'm filming her is to show Julie what her social anxiety looks like when others look at her. Wells, 2009, Chapter 4. What are we going to see on this video of you? I ask her before we start filming. I'm going to blush and stammer, and I'll probably get stuck. I'm insecure and boring to look at, Julie says. We carry out the exercise, and afterwards we watch the recording together. And Julie does stutter, and also gets red in the face, and seems a bit insecure. Sometimes she also loses eye contact with my colleague. How do you think the film compares to what you described beforehand? I ask her. It wasn't as bad as I thought. And you can't tell from the film what's really going on inside my head, she says. This realization is useful for her because life happens outside of your head. Shift your awareness. Another exercise I do with Julie is to ask her to listen to an audio recording. Wells, 2009, Chapter 4. This recording is specifically designed so that clients can learn to train their awareness and learn to shift their awareness from one point to another. I do not tell her anything other than there is a voice that will guide her, and she simply needs to do what the voice tells her for the approximately 12 minutes the recording lasts. This might be to focus on individual sounds or on several sounds at once. Before she does the exercise, I tell Julie that many different thoughts can come up, including thoughts that are not related to the audio file. But she should try to turn her thoughts back to what is happening on the recording as soon as she becomes aware that her thoughts are moving away from the recording. The aim of this exercise is for Julie to become aware that she already has some control over her awareness. It can always be improved, but for clients who carry out the audiophile exercise, it is often the first time they experience that they can control their awareness. After the first exercise with me during the therapy session, I ask her to practice this exercise once or twice a day. I stress that this is training and that she should not complete the exercise when she's not feeling well. You do not train to run with a broken leg either. But it is a good idea for Julie to carry out the exercise when she's feeling reasonably well. It is important that Julie herself realizes she can control her awareness and that it is not me who is telling her to do so. The same is true for all clients I have. Their realizations are crucial, and it is important for them to understand that controlling their awareness can also be applied to their thoughts and thought processes. Including how much or how little attention certain thoughts receive, it is the individual who needs to be in control of their thoughts, not vice versa. Action in spite of thoughts. Julie is also asked to make an audio recording of her tormenting thoughts such as these. They're looking at me strangely. My hands are shaking. I'm red in the face. They can see that I am socially anxious. I ask her to record her negative thoughts on her cell phone and make sure to record them on an app that can run on a voice loop. She must play the recording to herself continuously for 10 minutes while she's doing something else. She needs to do this once a day, and it does not matter what she's doing in the meantime, as long as she's doing it alone and does what she's doing at the moment. It could be washing up, tidying up, cooking. She just should not let herself stop the recording while she's doing her practical chores. One of the things Julie will learn from this exercise is that she can act even when her thoughts say otherwise. Even though her thoughts say, I have social anxiety, etc. With willpower, she can choose to do something else at the same time. The first time she tries this exercise, it takes place at my clinic. I have recorded her CAS-related thoughts, and while I run the recording, I ask her to count the leaves on a plant that I have standing in the therapy room. I also ask her to tell me what she is studying and to describe the sounds that she hears from the street outside. How can you explain that you can count the leaves, listen to what is happening outside, and have a conversation with me while your unwanted thoughts are running in a loop? What does this say about these thoughts? Can they prevent you from doing something that you should or want to do? No, actually they can't, Julie says. It can well be that the thoughts pop up now and then, but then you can direct your focus on the task again, and sometimes they disappear altogether. So what does this say about the power of your thoughts over your choice of action? That I can act even though my thoughts are running round and round, Julie says. Then Julie is going to make her own recording at home and carry out the exercise there. Sometimes I have clients who tell me that listening to their own negative thoughts is very painful at first, and they can hardly concentrate. But gradually, it becomes more annoying than painful to listen to them. And in the end, there are moments where they hardly notice that the recording is running. The point is that there is not a direct connection between your thoughts and actions. If Julie has a thought that tells her, "Oh, they're looking at me strangely, and I can't leave," it's just a thought. So she can still go despite having these thoughts. You can act with or without these thoughts, but you can still act. Julie has a choice, and this is being able to choose her response. So far, what she has done as soon as these thoughts appear is build the wall even higher and ended up never acting. But if she's going to a party at the university, she can still go even though she has worry thoughts. She does not need to let these thoughts control her. During the exercise, this happens on a smaller scale. Now I choose to do the dishes even though I have these thoughts. Thus, this exercise creates distance between the person and the thoughts and shows that you do not need to be fused with your thoughts, and hence, you can freely choose your actions. Also, see Wells, 2009, pages 84 to 85. Do you want to intellectualize? Then read Plato. Julie's progress is fast, and she is making great strides. But then what happens next is what ends up happening to many intellectual individuals, namely, the urge to analyze, ruminate, and understand reappears. After some sessions, she tells me that she's not sure she wants to be a person who does not analyze and understand things. "I'm a thinking being. If we're not going to use our heads, what are we going to do?" she says. But when are you being most intellectual? When you're ruminating about yourself, or when you are reflecting on the works of others, for example, to gain greater knowledge? Does constantly analyzing yourself make you become more intellectual? We cannot keep finding interesting things about ourselves. This becomes circular thinking, where no new knowledge emerges, because there is always an inward focus. There is something that the brain can occupy itself with, but nothing new. This is why it'll end badly. In Julie's case, she also uses intellectualizing as a form of avoidance, because in this way, she could avoid addressing her anxiety and doing the things that needed to be done. She sat down and thought about things instead of going out into the world. Avoidance falls under CAS-related behavior, and it needs to be reduced if you're going to make the desired progress. The ability to analyze and reflect is used successfully by many people in their work. Researchers, teachers, and journalists whose success is based on being able to do these things, among others, but only when it concerns their working lives. The problem arises when these strategies are applied to the psyche and mental processes where you stay in a particular way of thinking for too long and are not particularly aware of your thought processes. There is a big difference between using a strategy when it comes to outward focus, for example in your working life, than when it comes to inward focus. Sometimes I say to a client, "If you like to analyze things, why don't you take up Plato's works and analyze them? And when you're finished with them, you can move on to French literature," and so on. Does it all have to be about you? In Julie's case, her positive metacognitions and the need to think and reflect take up too much time, and she is clearly heavily influenced by the university environment she's in. It is fine to ask critical questions, but when it comes to thoughts, these questions should be about thought processes and not the content of the thoughts themselves, because the content does not matter. When we succeed in minimizing the time people spend on excessive internal thinking that just goes round in circles, what happens is that they experience an easing of their anxiety or the other forms of mental distress. The wall of CAS cannot always be completely eradicated, but it can be reduced to the point where it's possible to move over it. A problem one without a problem two. While we are working on reducing Julie's CAS, she is called in for an employee interview at her student job. She likes the job and thinks she's doing a good job, but is afraid that her social anxiety is a problem at work. At the interview, she is told, quite rightly, that she's not social enough. Her employer wants her to share more of herself and talk more with her colleagues. Julie herself does not feel that she needs to talk more with her colleagues. Most of her colleagues have small children, houses and gardens, trying to juggle work life with family life. And Julie is not at a point in her life where she can share their conversations about children's sick days, new kitchens and in-laws. So Julie does not want to be more social in this way. And it is therefore not a problem for her that she does not engage in social relationships with her colleagues. Her reaction is therefore not an expression of her CAS response, nor is it Julie's social anxiety that is at play. It is more an expression of how her employer and colleagues have some wishes that Julie cannot meet, and so this might not be the right workplace for her. Julie ends up being fired, which of course makes her sad, but this also makes her think about which job she should apply for in the future. Whether she should find a workplace with other requirements, or whether she wants to learn how to engage in small talk and therefore needs to practice. These questions are about personal choice, so she does not need to start worrying and mulling over them. Julie did not develop a new problem because of being fired, and she got through it as painlessly as possible. After 8 sessions, we stopped therapy. Julie has minimized her wall of CAS and is feeling better about her studies. She no longer worries for several hours before she goes to a lecture or a party. This change also means that her anxiety has been significantly reduced. She coped with being fired from her job as a problem 1 without developing a problem 2. It meant a lot to her that she was capable of tackling and solving this problem without creating more problems. Tools. Safety behavior. If you suffer from social phobia or social anxiety, you're often convinced that you will behave in an improper or inappropriate way and therefore will be rejected, lose social status or dignity, or that you will lose an opportunity to achieve a desired goal. Some typical thoughts may include, "Oh no, my hands are shaking so others can see that I'm anxious. They think that I'm odd. I'm boring and will only say uninteresting things. I might say something wrong and make a fool of myself. If I sweat, people will see that I'm not professional enough for the job. I'll get red in the face and people will laugh at me." Common for these types of thoughts are that they often trigger safety behavior. We use safety behavior to conceal our anxiety. We try to prevent others from seeing us in a certain way, which corresponds to a self-created negative self-image. A safety behavior might be trying to conceal your shaking hands by sitting on them or hiding them behind your back so that no one can see them. Or a safety behavior might be looking down at the floor when you get red in the face. Or you might wear loose clothing to conceal how much you tend to sweat whenever you're nervous. It could also be speaking much too softly or much too fast so that no one notices a speech impediment. Or it could be speaking very little so that you are less likely to say something wrong or boring. Safety behavior usually leads to an enormous self-focus. This does not mean that we are egotistic or self-centered, but when we are self-focused, we pay excessive attention to how we appear and behave. We see ourselves from the outside and notice all the undesired details. This awareness can lead to an increase in bodily reactions, tendencies such as sweating, shaking, and getting red in the face. And these reactions are precisely what we want to avoid. But the more we focus on not sweating or shaking, the more likely it is that these reactions will happen. Safety behavior exacerbates the problem. We must therefore work with 2 steps. Less and eventually no safety behavior. Less self-focus and instead a lot of outward focus. An important step in the metacognitive treatment of social phobia is therefore to minimize safety behavior and eventually let it go completely. If we do this gradually in small steps, it is less uncomfortable because it can seem overwhelming to have to get started. You can make a list of your typical safety behaviors and think about how you can slowly but consistently reduce these by constantly taking small steps. And you can choose some social situations where your anxiety is only moderate and where you can decide to not use any safety behaviors at all. Another equally important step is to minimize your self-focus. Self-focus is a form of inward focus, and the goal is therefore to replace frequent self-focus with outward focus. This means trying to shift the focus in social situations to something external rather than looking at yourself, your bodily reactions, your appearance, and your behavior. Leave these thoughts alone and focus instead on something external. For example, on other people. How many women are there? How many men? How many are wearing black clothes? And how many are wearing red? The point is that the less self-focused you are, the less your body will react, and therefore you will feel less anxiety. This exercise is inspired by Wells, 1997, Chapter 7, Wells, 2009.